One of the biggest threats to the global economy? You are not going to believe me when I tell you who it is. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today, the 10th of February. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. As President Trump and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe begin their golf weekend in Florida today, that is the people running the biggest and third biggest economies on the planet, it is worth taking a step back, I believe, to take a look at the week that was in the global economy. Here to do it with us are Neela Richardson at Redfin. Cardiff Garcia is at the blog FT Alphaville. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
So, Neela, let me start with you and a report that came out today from Fitch Ratings, one of the big three credit ratings agencies. And they said in this evaluation of the global economy, and this is a quote, "The Trump administration represents a risk to international economic conditions. U.S. policy predictability has diminished, raising the prospect of sudden, unanticipated changes in U.S. policies with potential global implications." I wonder, Neela, whether the global economy knew what it was getting itself into when Donald Trump became president of the United States.
Well, if they didn't, they do now. Yes, that's right. Fitch actually thinks a risk to the global economy, an economy that has been stagnating, has had very slow growth in the last few years, that there's a big risk to the Trump administration's policies going forward. And it's not just the policies. It's the fact that the economy can't predict these policies. Yeah. There's an aggressive stance, an American first attitude in which companies are being discouraged, actually, to invest abroad. There's a discouragement also for foreign companies and investors to invest in the United States. And since no one knows the direction of the policies and where they will ultimately lead, it's hard for foreign governments to plan. Fitch is saying that's a risk to their very ability to raise debt in the capital markets.
Cardiff, let me go to the phone call last night between President Xi Jinping and President Trump, a last-minute turnaround in which the president said, oh, yeah, we are going to abide by the one-China policy, which, if you remember back in December, he had said, we'll use it as a bargaining chip, whatever. Now here he is calling the president of China the second biggest economy in the world. This is all happening at a very high level.
At a very high level, I should also add that things are happening at a very fast pace and that Trump has changed his mind multiple times on other issues before. So next week we might be talking about some new kind of confrontation. Who knows? But if not, then I think this is a sort of welcome addition to stability. Whether it lasts is anybody's guess. But as Neela said, it's important to bring up things like uncertainty, like unpredictability, because these things sound like squishy topics, but not everything that matters to the global economy is easy to quantify or easy to measure. So to the extent that there is somewhat of a softening happening, and there aren't too many signs of it, but to the extent that it does happen, then I think it's something to be welcomed.
So, Neela, on a domestic policy front, then, the president said yesterday when he was talking to those airline CEOs, he said, we're going to have a phenomenal tax plan, at which point Republicans in Congress went, whoa, wait a minute. We have to deal with Obamacare and a bunch of other stuff before we get to the tax plan. There is a domestic unpredictability here in a macroeconomic sense that plays as well.
Right. There is. And remember how Trump got elected. It was for Rust Belt economics, people who voted for him because of their pocketbooks, because of what he would do in the economy, not abroad. And so that should be the focus. And yet that focus is being supplanted by all these other executive orders that cover Obamacare and travel bans and don't really seem to be going back to the voting issue, which is the economy. And the good news is, though, that Trump could actually provide that stability, that predictability, both at home and abroad. And if that were to happen, we might see some good things. It's possible from some of the things that are in the works, like an overhaul of corporate taxes.
Yeah. Cardiff, let me actually pick up on what you said about stuff getting bogged down. It's becoming somewhat more clear that the big economic things that the president campaigned on, things like infrastructure, things like tax reform, are in fact going to not happen as fast because the White House and the body politic is having to deal with all of this other stuff.
Yeah, I think so far from all the reports we've had, It seems increasingly obvious that at least in these initial phases, the Trump administration seems a bit overwhelmed or even outmatched by the job itself. And they're learning that it requires quite a lot of coordination and collaboration to roll out big ideas, because if not, then the sheer controversy that ensues ends up bogging you down. I mean, running a country is very different from running a business. And I think they're learning that really quite quickly. And it looks like they're frustrated by it.
Yeah, Neela, go ahead.
And Kai, the biggest difference is that when you run a country, people say no to you a lot. Not so much when you run a family business.
Well, pick it up there, Cardiff, and discuss what it means in practical terms, right? Because the president used to sort of run his company as he would and now just can't.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Keep in mind also that a lot of Trump's businesses in the past, certainly the ones that have succeeded, have been sort of focused on image, right? Well,
image
matters, and we learned that in the election, certainly. But at the same time, you also have to produce results. And running a country means you have many, many different constituents, not just your own pocketbook and not just your own company's stakeholders, right?
Yeah.
And so accommodating everybody is a really difficult task. It means that you have to compromise. You have to essentially help other people compromise as well. And that means you have to have, you have to have your fingers in almost everything. And it's really hard. It's a big coordination task. And you can see that so far, at least, he's been frustrated quite a bit by just everything that it entails. But that's the job. That is the job.
Cardiff Garcia at the blog FT Alphaville. Neela Richardson at Redfin. Thanks, you two.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kai.
All right. Have a nice weekend, everybody. All sunshine and light on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The White House this week released the official list of members of the president's cabinet. 24 people in all, from Vice President Mike Pence on down to the head of the Small Business Administration, Linda McMahon. Conspicuously absent, at least for business and economic journalists, the head of the White House Council of Economic Advisors. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explores what that might portend policy-wise.
Some of the country's top economists have led the Council of Economic Advisors, including Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen. So, is it a big deal that the head of the council won't be in President Trump's cabinet?
It's a symbolic decision by the president.
That's Donald Marin. He served in George W. Bush's Council of Economic Advisors and is now at the Urban Institute. Marin says the council gives presidents unvarnished advice.
Economists are very often the people who identify things as being bad ideas and kill them while they're young.
President Trump is getting economic advice from former Goldman Sachs president Gary Cohen. He's head of the National Economic Council. He's right in the White House and helps coordinate and frame economic policy. But he's not an economist, and the National Economic Council is more political, according to Bob Murphy, a senior economist on former President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors.
Politics matters, but in the end, the danger would be the economic voice gets shut out.
So, does President Trump just not like economists? I asked Stephen Moore, a former economic advisor to the Trump campaign, now at the Heritage Foundation.
I think he likes economists who agree with him.
Moore says Trump understands the economy, but still needs an economist by his side to explain things like
how differences in tax policies will affect the economy in different ways.
Moore says the key is whether Trump will listen to his Council of Economic Advisors, not whether the council chair is in the cabinet. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
You can say this for the president. He is totally making late-night television great again. Saturday Night Live is on a roll, and weeknights are seeing a bump, too, as the shows and the hosts with the sharpest political humor get the most viewers. Case in point, Stephen Colbert on The Late Show on CBS won the time slot last week, beating Jimmy Fallon over on NBC. Marketplace's Annie Baxter looks at how late-night political satire is having its day.
Before the election season, late-night shows were doing fine, but they weren't pushing the envelope much. So says Dan Wilch with Frank Maggot Associates, a media consulting firm.
The primary thing happening were sort of kind of fluff. I mean, good things to go to bed to, but nothing that was that thought-provoking or controversial.
Like this Jimmy Fallon take on teenage girl talk.
I'm Sarah, And if you're wondering, that's S-I-R-I with no H because H's are out.
Hollywood Reporter TV editor Marisa Guthrie says comedians found potential targets back then, like President Obama, harder to satirize.
Because he was so contained and so on message.
By contrast, President Trump's administration has some larger-than-life personalities. And some of the hosts succeeding today, like Stephen Colbert, were stamped by the political satire of The Daily Show. David Craig is a media expert at the University of Southern California.
It's a combination of Trump, Daily Show, and social media that I think has sparked this renaissance in political content and rating higher ratings on these talk shows.
And of course, Saturday Night Live is enjoying its highest ratings in decades. Dan Wilch says the daily flood of news is actually pushing more people to watch shows as they air.
You want to see how they're talking about it. You make more of a point to watch it live.
That's a boon for networks who can tell advertisers they'll have plenty of eyeballs watching. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Whether President Trump's wall on the Mexican border ever gets built and whoever is going to pay for it, a big chunk of the day-to-day work of dealing with illegal border crossings is going to fall to the cops and the sheriffs in the communities on that border, both sides of the border. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports now from Nogales, Arizona and Nogales, Mexico.
Sergeant Omar Rodriguez of the Santa Cruz County Sheriff's Department has been patrolling the U.S.-Mexico border for years.
We're going to be in the air in case we get any sensor hits.
1406. Rodriguez knows this mix of cattle ranches, golf courses, and scrubby desert so well, he can navigate it in the dark, which is often when he's on duty.
There's not much signs or street signs, nothing like that. So everything is by landmarks. That's how we guide ourselves.
There's the telltale rumble as his truck bumps over a cattle guard embedded in the road, a really big mesquite tree. He checks them off in his head as he focuses on something else.
We get a lot of foreign nationals coming through here, a lot of drug smuggling through the area. You always see groups coming through here.
During patrols, Rodriguez frequently backs up federal border agents. He can do things they may not be able to, like make routine traffic stops.
They let us know, hey, we're after a group of five, or we have suspicious vehicle in this area. Can you guys check up on it?
But Rodriguez says he doesn't make as many stops as he did in the past.
I'll say 5-6 years ago, it was on a daily basis that we will stop vehicles with immigrants. Nowadays, it's rare. They're being very cautious, so it's gone down as far as the activity.
But even when he isn't working with Border Patrol, the sheriff's office has other, more grim, duties in the wilderness along the border.
Unfortunately, we get remains from foreign nationals that we have to recover, and we have to make those hikes, sometimes a mile, sometimes a couple miles, depending on the area, but it's a very rough terrain to walk.
He says they usually recover about a dozen bodies a year. Some people die trying to cross the desert. Others are victims of violence associated with drug trafficking. Rodriguez doubts walls or more technology will stop people from crossing the border. He points to the tall concrete and metal fence that snakes along the horizon.
People still climbing like if it was a ladder. I don't know how they do it. You can see people climbing those posts like if it was nothing. With a 40-pound bundle on their backs.
On the other side of the border, in Nogales, Mexico, I meet Romero Garcia of the Nogales Municipal Police in front of a wide entrance to the city's storm drainage system. He and several other officers are heavily armed with automatic weapons. Drug cartels hold a lot of power in Nogales.
We come and do regular rounds. We get reports from citizens that there are strange people in the tunnel, and that's how we find out.
As we enter the tunnel, the water runs ankle deep. A towel hangs from a protruding nail where a homeless person has left it to dry. Half a dozen random shoes are caught in protruding nets of upturned rebar that can be hard to see in the darkness, even with a headlamp. Garcia says sometimes the water flows fast and deep through here, drowning the unsuspecting.
Migrants use this tunnel also. Actually, they are the ones who use it the most to go to America. But rather than use it and entering through here, they go through different openings and holes in the ground, and then they connect farther down, closer to the border.
Garcia takes us to just such a place.
One more, yes?
We climb down a drain opening in a cartel-controlled neighborhood. We're being watched. People peer out from behind curtains, eyeing the police-escorted group as we head into the well-used entrance. Once below, an officer scouts ahead before we rejoin the same tunnel as before, this time much closer to the U.S.
There is a border right there.
Garcia literally points out a light at the end of the tunnel. As we move close, two heavy metal gates come into view, and it turns out we're being watched again. A door swings open, and two American Border Patrol agents come out to investigate. In Nogales, Mexico, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Kimberly's reporting on the border was supported by the International Women's Media Foundation's Adelante Reporting Fellowship. Coming up.
One of the main reasons why I signed up for Medicaid was because my copay was $200, and I can't afford that.
Repeal and replace, and then what? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials were up 96 points today, about 0.5% on the blue chips, closed at 20,269. NASDAQ up 18 points, about 0.3%, 5734. The S&P 500 gained 8 points, 0.3%, 23.16. There for the week gone by, the 5 days that was. Or were. I don't know. The Dow up 1%, the NASDAQ up 1.2%, S&P 500 added 0.8%. Somebody please tweet at me. Let me know which it is, all right? Oil companies advanced as crude prices rose. ExxonMobil moved up 0.8%. Newfield Exploration added 2.1%. ConocoPhillips oozed up 1.2% as well. Skechers kicked up 19.3% today. That after posting stronger than expected quarterly revenue, the shoe retailer reported especially strong sales in China. Video game maker Activision Blizzard roared up 18.8% on fourth quarter earnings that pretty much blew away expectations. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everybody. Molly here.
It's Kai, but you already knew that.
You did. But we have something that we would like to tell you together.
We are doing a new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, about the things we want to know more about but don't always have time to dig into on this daily program.
Yeah, and it's about you, too, the things that you want to know more about and the things that you're an expert on. We'd like to have you on the show, too.
And mostly it's me and Molly having fun. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart. There's lots more info there.
And please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you podcast.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Sears announced a big restructuring plan today. Another restructuring plan, I ought to say. The company has been circling the drain for a good long while now. CEO Eddie Lempert's tried cashing in on real estate holdings and focusing on the store's loyalty program have done nothing. So this time, he's going to focus on cutting costs. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra asked around to see how that might work out.
The Sears plan is less about rebounding and more about treading water. Randy Allen teaches at Cornell's S.C. Johnson College of Business.
What they're doing is trying to look at ways to generate additional cash. You know, they need cash to operate their business.
The plan is to drum up that cash by selling stores and meanwhile cut at least $1 billion in expenses. Philip Emma, who covers Sears for DebtWire, says none of this is new.
They're doing what effectively they've been doing over the last few years. They're continuing to monetize assets.
Mohan Sawhney is a professor at the Kellogg School of Management. He says Eddie Lampert isn't a traditional retail CEO.
I call it management by spreadsheet, you know, or management by financial engineering.
He also owns a hedge fund, ESL Investments, which owns a large stake in Sears. And Sawhney says Lampert's financial engineering isn't going to fix the company.
Fundamentally, you have to address the problem that customers aren't coming into stores and their same-store sales are continuing to decline.
There's another problem that Lampert's plan doesn't seem to address. Randy Allen at Cornell says Sears doesn't have a good sense of where it fits into the marketplace.
maybe there is a miracle that they can find the right niche and they can do it, but the competition that they're going up against is stronger all the time.
Sears is 124 years old, and in a market crammed with young online players, it's starting to look its age. In New York, I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
As retailers close the books on 2016 holiday shopping and turn to their 2017 prospects, things seem to be going pretty well. Consumer spending and confidence are both up. And yet, with online shopping taking an ever bigger chunk of business, national chains like Macy's and Abercrombie & Fitch and, oh yeah, Sears have announced store closures and layoffs by the thousands. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more on the retail churn and the national economy from our bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting.
David Schick at Consumer Edge Research points out that online retail has already captured 15% of sales.
And that's growing at something like 15% year over year. So most of retail growth is occurring outside of a store.
Meaning most of the job growth is in fulfillment warehouses and truck depots, where your order for clothes or gadgets gets processed and shipped. These new jobs pay about the same as the old store-based ones, says Kathy Ruckelshaus at the National Employment Law Project.
They're both very low, hovering near the bottom of the labor market in terms of hourly wages.
Still, it's a job seeker's market right now in e-commerce logistics hubs all over the country, like Louisville, Kentucky, where Amy Glazer at staffing firm Adecco says local employers are offering
additional incentives, 401k bonus, tuition reimbursement, health and wellness programs, other things like, free meals.
John Challenger at outplacement firm Challenger Gray & Christmas says these jobs won't replace all those sales associates and store clerks at the mall.
The big distribution centers don't need as many people stocking the shelves and hauling inventory around because robotics do so much more of it.
Jobs that are in high demand and pay very well in online retail: software engineer, programmer, statistician, the people who develop and run all the algorithms and artificial intelligence that keeps e-commerce humming. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Congressman Tom Price was confirmed as Secretary of Health and Human Services in the wee small hours of this morning. So now for the new secretary comes the heavy lifting, the as yet undefined Republican replacement for the Affordable Care Act, which President Trump has promised this year or maybe next. Part of the overhaul is likely to include changes to Medicaid, the program that serves low-income Americans, children, and the disabled, which was, as you might remember, greatly expanded under Obamacare. The talk right now, and once again it is just talk, is that Medicaid could be in for some massive restructuring. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY, Dan Gorenstein talks to some of the people who became eligible for Medicaid under Obamacare and the impact that's had on them.
It's a long climb up for Dane Pangonis. The 27-year-old recovering alcoholic goes for group therapy here on the second floor of this building in West Philadelphia. Substance abuse is just one of Pangonis's health worries.
Depression, anxiety. I have neurological problems. I have problems with concentration. I've been talking with my, I was seeing a neuropsychologist. So my don't concentrate on things. I can't remember things,
Pangonis, who's gay, is also at high risk for contracting HIV. So he takes a drug regimen that's called pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP.
One of the main reasons why I signed up for Medicaid was because I lost my job. I didn't have the income to continue paying for my insurance, but I was also taking PrEP. My copay was $200, and I can't afford that.
Pangonis is one of about 12 million Americans who have gotten coverage under the Medicaid expansion. Before, most states covered mainly people who were poor, well below the federal poverty level, and only if they had children. Someone like Pangonis would have been out of luck. To date, 31 states have expanded coverage to include childless adults like him and people slightly above the poverty level. But that expanded coverage could disappear under this new Congress. Harvard economist and physician Ben Summer says that would be short-sighted.
Study after study that have been published both before and since the ACA show that when people get Medicaid from being uninsured, they're more likely to have primary care, they're more likely to be able to take their medications.
Studies have also shown depression rates drop, people feel more financially secure, and say they're in better health. But critics point out Medicaid has had only a modest impact on chronic diseases like diabetes, and it's costly. Economist John Goodman with the Conservative Independent Institute believes taxpayers and people on Medicaid would get a better deal if government backed away from health care.
I would like to give people who are on Medicaid an opportunity to take those same dollars and buy private health insurance.
That's sure to be one of the arguments as Congress takes up the Obamacare overhaul. Another certainty, politicians not wanting to take it away. But back in Philadelphia, Dane Pangonis isn't focused on the political back and forth. He's just wondering if he'll be able to keep taking his PrEP. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which the Wags on Finance Twitter dubbed the ultimate hedge this morning. The British consumer products company Reckitt Benckiser Group is buying Mead Johnson Nutrition for $16.5 billion. Mead Johnson makes, among other things, baby formula. Reckitt Benckiser makes, among other things, condoms. All right, that's all we got on a Friday. The Dow up 96 points today, about a half percent. The NASDAQ up 18 points, a third percent. The S&P 500 up 8 points, a third percent there as well. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you on Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.